The Book of Acts, chapter 23, verses 12 to 35. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand, and going aside asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the governor of Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him. Having learned that he was a Roman citizen and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. And when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium.
...30,000-foot view of the last number of chapters of the book of Acts. Sometimes when you start walking through particular texts and you kind of take smaller texts, you lose the big picture. I just want to remind you of a couple of things that stand out big picture in the last couple of chapters of what we've studied in the book of Acts and where we are going. The two things that stand out, more than anything, I would suggest to you in Paul's life, because what we've seen is essentially about Paul, right? He's finished his three missionary journeys. He gives his farewell address to the elders at Ephesus, and he begins this journey to Jerusalem. We're in Jerusalem right now. We're just going to start leaving Jerusalem at the end of today's text. And he's therefore, after that, going to Rome, because that's what he talked about back in chapter 19. I need to go to Jerusalem and I need to go to Rome. That's where we are. The two things that stand out about this journey that we're on with Paul right now is he faces a lot of opposition, a lot of persecution, a lot of affliction. Some of you have said, we've been talking about affliction and persecution a lot. That's what the text is showing us. There's a lot of persecution, a lot of affliction, a lot of suffering, a lot of opposition for Paul. That's number one. And yet, in spite of that, Paul keeps on speaking. He doesn't shut up. He keeps on speaking. Persecution, talks more, leads to more persecution, and in fact, leads to more opportunity to speak. That's what's been going on. And he does speak a lot. Right? He speaks a ton. Now, he comes out of that time speaking to the elders at Ephesus. He goes down to Tyre. He speaks to people there. He goes to Caesarea. He speaks to people there. He goes to Jerusalem. He's arrested there. He's beaten there. But he says, I need to have a chance to tell these people about what I'm about. So he speaks to the people there in Acts chapter 22. Last week, he spoke to the Sanhedrin, the council. James walked through that address. He speaks there. And we're going to see that he keeps on speaking. He's going to speak next week to Felix. He'll speak to Felix and one other individual, Agrippa, excuse me, thank you, Agrippa and Bernice. And then he will finally appeal to speak to Caesar. And that's how the book of Acts ends. He gets to Rome and he's waiting to have audience with Caesar in Rome. Those two things. He speaks, he gets persecuted, he speaks. All of that is the catalyst for today's message. All right. All of that sets up what I want to talk about today. By the way, if you're into movies, making movies, starring in movies, producing movies, directing movies, today's text would make a great movie. There's espionage and 11th hour rescues, and there's unsung heroes, and there's all of that, man. It is great. It is fantastic. 3D it, man. Paul coming at you, coming back would be great. All right. And weaved within all of that stuff, those foiled opportunities and those midnight flights that we're going to see, is the ever-present hand of God on Paul. Okay? So that's the intro. That sets everything up. That's what we need to keep in mind. Let's pick things up in verse 12. It begins with a discussion of conspiracy against Paul. Look at the first half of verse 12. It says, when it was day, the Jews made a plot. Okay? They make a plot, and their plot is shown at the end of verse 12, that same verse. What they want to do is they want to kill Paul. So that's their plot. And it was a plot bound by an oath. You can see the oath at the end of verse 12, second half of it. They bound themselves by an oath. Here it is, to neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul, which for me would take about a half an hour. Need to get it done. Half hour. All right. For them, it may have lasted longer. They had an oath, right? They wouldn't eat or drink until they killed Paul. Pretty good motivation. Additionally, it was an oath that was strongly supported. It wasn't just one or two individuals. In fact, verse 13 says there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. So it's not just a few, not just a couple of hotheads. It was a group of 40 who were committed to this cause. But in addition, this group of 40 also had support from others. Their plot was going to be carried out in conjunction with the leadership of the day, the religious leadership of the day, the people that pulled the strings of the day. Look at verses 14 and 15. They, that group of 40, went to the chief priests and the elders. That's the council, that's that Sanhedrin that we saw last week and have seen throughout, and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him, Paul, down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near, right? There's their plan. And they're in bed with this group. And it's a pretty good plan. What you guys need to do, they say to the leadership factor at that time, is call for Paul to be released or brought down from his prison situation, the barracks, and have him come to where you guys, right, you guys meet. Right? Their particular place is on the, where they gather is on the southwest corner of the temple. And so to bring Paul from the barracks to the southwest corner of the temple would necessitate that Paul be brought through the courtyard of the Gentiles. Perfect place for ambush. So we need to appreciate what's going on here, right? It's a good plan. It's supported by a group of 40, good motivation, supported by those in leadership. All of this is pretty daunting stuff. Does not look good for Paul. Here's my first point coming out of this text. And it really, it just serves as a reminder for us. Okay, just to get the discussion going a little bit and start unpacking this and applying it to our lives. So just take this as a reminder. My first point this morning is that our battle ultimately isn't against flesh and blood. See, in spite of the opposition that is arising against Paul, they weren't his biggest factor of consideration for him. And I can say that and speak on behalf of Paul with assurance, because that's exactly what Paul says in other places, in places that he writes. For example, in Ephesians 6, a fairly well-known text to some of you who have grown up in the church, he writes in Ephesians 6:12, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Peter supports this when he writes in 1 Peter 5:8, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. There's more going on to what than what we can see and touch, feel around us. That's the point of this. As I've talked about much over the years here at Westside, in our day and age where everybody and their dog is spiritual, literally, everybody and their dog is spiritual. And I agree, we are spiritual, not your dog, hate to break it to you, but we as spiritual people, right, as spiritual people, we need to recognize that in the same way that there are the presence, is the presence of good and evil in our world, so too is the presence of good and evil in the spiritual realm. And we would be naive, I think, to think anything different. And that's why I caution people when they talk about what people do, oftentimes when they talk about their spirituality, is that there is this sort of idea that when we involve ourselves in spiritual things, it just is going to be altogether good. Why would we think that? I mean, if people are spiritual as well as physical, if we have soul and flesh, spirit and flesh, and I agree that we do, and people live out in fleshly ways those things that are evil, why would we think the spiritual realm is only altogether good? What we have Paul and Peter here saying, look, the spiritual realm exists. There's cosmic forces. There's leaders in the heavenly places. And in the same way that there are good aspects of the spiritual, we have an enemy, the devil, who prowls, and his minions who support and undergird what he wants to see take place. Now, it's not to suggest that Paul didn't have a real flesh and blood issue on his hands, but instead it's a reminder that if we simply attempt to face what we see without considering it prayerfully, the spiritual behind it, in other words, we fight a battle with less armor than we need. If that first point just serves as a reminder, my second point comes right out of this text, and it is persecution can oftentimes come from people on our own team. Remember how Paul addressed this group back in verse 1 of chapter 22, just last chapter? You can probably see it there in your own text. He addresses this people group as brothers and fathers, right? Fathers, brothers, brothers, fathers. Why does he address them like that? Well, because quite simply, they were part of the nation of Israel. He was a Jewish man. They were Jewish individuals. They were part family, some of them. I mean, blood relatives, some of them, but certainly part of the same nation. Right? Also had the same religion. Right? They had the same belief in what Paul's been arguing for. He says, I'm not against what you believe, you just need to go further. Everything that we've believed in finds its fulfillment in Jesus. So I'm with you. I'm not down. I'm not abolishing that. All right. I want you to see the fulfillment of what we have believed up to this point in Jesus. So these are brothers and fathers nationally and religiously. But in addition to that, these are individuals that Paul had done ministry with, work with, served with, partnered with, and now they are individuals who are plotting, conspiring murderously against him. But what is going on here is nothing new in the book of Acts, however. Those who represent the religion of the day fought hard against the mission of Jesus as carried on by the apostles and the early church. You know, it would be my contention today that the religious are a far greater problem to the mission of the mission of Jesus in North America than the culture around us. And certainly on a global scale, Christianity is no more persecuted than in countries entrenched in religiosity. But the religious aren't alone in the opposition in the story of Acts and in the Gospels. Politicians consistently resisted as well for different reasons. But don't forget the Sadducees. Who are those cowboys? Who are the Sadducees? The Sadducees are the aristocracy of the day. Really didn't get involved in spiritual matters, but they liked the position that was afforded them as they partnered in the Sanhedrin. But they were the big bucked individuals. They were the upper crust, man. That's them, all right? That's them. It is not going too far to say that it was the religious and the political and the financial powers who attempted to snuff out the mission of Jesus most fervently, because in their minds, they had the most to lose. But again, I would suggest to you that all three continue to attempt to do the same today. So Paul was encountering opposition from within, not from without. And is it not true, West Side, that the most devastating opposition that comes our way is that which oftentimes comes from those closest to us? That's what Paul is facing. But, verse 16, let's pick it up. Now the son of Paul's sister, I think that's a nephew if I figured it out right, if I know familial relationships. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell you." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand. Don't miss that. This is a kid. All right? This isn't a 16, 17-year-old. This is a kid, probably not even 8, 9, perhaps 10 years old yet. Took him by the hand and going aside asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow," as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. "But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Just stop there. This is nothing if not a great act of God's grace on Paul. I mean, don't miss this. One of Paul's nephews, who happened to serve in some capacity in the temple, we don't know what his capacity was, he heard of the plot to ambush Uncle Paul. This provision of God, coming in the form of Paul's nephew, leads to my next two points coming out of these verses, verses 16 to 22. Here's the first. Jesus' promises will not be stopped, regardless of the oaths or the plans or the contingents raised up against him. Now, what type of promise am I talking about specifically pertaining to Paul? Well, remember verse 11 from last week where James ended off our time? Look at verse 11. You see the promise and who it comes from in that verse. "The following night, the Lord stood by Paul and said, 'Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome.'" There's the promise. None of this was a deterrent to Jesus' promise to Paul. Be courageous. You must testify in Rome. Now, I'm not suggesting that this wasn't a test of faith for Paul. In fact, I'm declaring this as just the opposite. This was a great test necessitating courageous faith for Paul. And we encounter similar tests of faith too. Perhaps not to the same degree, oftentimes less, but sometimes even more. In a verse that I took you to a couple of weeks ago, Peter writes that we can expect these tests of faith. Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 4, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you." Why do they come? To test you. And as I have said many times over the years of this ministry, we want our faith to be tested. Just reason with me a little bit in this and why I say that. If a Christian is saved by faith, and not by works. Right? Now, if you're new to the church, you're asking questions about the Christian faith, that's a major pillar of our faith. You can do nothing to earn your salvation. Right? Nothing. But we are saved by faith, not by works. Why? So none of us can boast. None of us are going to get up here and go, "I earned my salvation by doing this, 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 and not doing that, that, and that." That's not how salvation is attained. It's attained by faith. So if we are saved by faith and not by works, then doesn't it make sense that we would want to have our faith tested to ensure its validity? But I want you to note what is altogether critical in this. This test of faith here isn't about whether or not Paul believes that Jesus came and died and rose again. That's not the test of faith. Paul believed that. This was a test specific to a situation. Would Paul trust in the promise of Jesus in this situation? And that's where our faith is tested most often as well. Most of us, however, wrongly evaluate whether our faith is strong or not by whether we still believe in Jesus or not. I still believe in Jesus. I believe in Jesus. I believe that He's my Savior. I'm good. My faith is good. But can I ask you, do you believe Him with your finances? And with your business? And in your relationships? And in your marriage? And with your kids and your health? Do you believe Him in that? See, we can oftentimes talk about believing in Jesus with unbelief all the while guiding the rest of our lives. In our business practices, in our relationships, or how we answer questions, or how we try to present ourselves, or how we walk through tough times. Personally speaking, I don't think I could believe in Jesus as being God in flesh, having come down, died for my sin, buried, raising from the dead 3 days later, conquering sin and death, presenting Himself up to 500 people at one time in His resurrected, physical resurrected state, now ascended, sitting at the right hand of God in heaven. The Father sitting at His right hand side, serving in intercessory ways for me, and will one day come back again. I don't think I can believe it any more than I do right now. I believe that. I believe that. But Westside, what you need to know about me is that there are many areas in my life where unbelief surfaces and God tests those areas all the time. When Paul writes in Romans 1 about those who exchange the truth of God for a lie and serve and worship created things and not the Creator, he was writing about us as much as anyone. Many times we find our status and our comfort and our experiences and who we are, our reputation, so altogether important that we turn our eyes from God and we serve and we worship it. We go from Creator to created things. And that's why the cry of the Father in Mark chapter 1, when He cries out, "I believe, but help my unbelief," needs to be our cry constantly as we walk with Jesus in this life. It's repentant helplessness. I believe, but in this area, there's no evidence of belief. I believe, but in that, I'm taking matters into my own hands. This constant battle waged between belief and unbelief and the testing of our faith is why Paul writes in Ephesians 2, very well-known text. Again, if you grew up in the church, you've probably heard this, but it is so altogether important to us. He writes, "We are saved by grace through faith." Why is that important? Why is that language so important? That we are saved not by amazing faith, but by amazing grace? Why does Paul write that we are saved by grace through faith? Well, let me say this as clearly as I can. And for some of you, this will be a challenge. And for others of you, this will free you up. But I want to say it as clearly as I can. None of us, you, me, any of us, have the necessary faith to save us. None of our faith by itself is good enough, strong enough, nor pure enough to save us. None of us. And therefore, Paul writes that we are saved by grace through faith. Praise God. In fact, our faith itself has been graced to us as well. Jesus is the author of your faith, not you. Even our faith is a gift. Why is this so important to us? It's important because if you and I say that we are saved by grace through faith for our salvation, and yet live lives where God's gracious faith doesn't surface in the day-to-day of it. Again, in how we do money or how we do relationships or health or retirement and everything in between, then how can we say we have a faith that saves? Paul, I know you believe in me, but will you believe in me in this? And Westside, that's why we want our faith tested. I mean, so many of us, we say we have faith that guarantees our salvation. Like, think, yet with the smaller matters of our life, and they are, compared to our eternality, small. We live lives that there is no demonstration whatsoever in those small things. And that's why we want God to test us. And so he tested Paul and he tests us as well. I said that there are two points coming out of verses 16 to 22. Here's the second. Persecution finds support in unusual places. I said to the first gathering, I said to a couple guys on staff, that's like a Max Lucado point. If you've read, it's kind of fluffy, right? Kind of like a bunny should give it to you or something. I'm not sure. It's a precious moment statement, right? But it's true. I know it's kind of fluffy and nice, right? But it's true, but it's fluffy. I recognize that. But support does. Persecution finds support in unusual places. Just think about the people that have supported Paul, come to his aid, surprisingly. Already, just up to this point, we're going to get to a third in just a second. The two that stand out up to this point are his nephew, right? We've seen him in verse 16. And also, don't miss the centurion in verse 17. Centurion didn't need to listen to Paul, let alone help him. This prison scene, by the way, it's not the first prison scene in the book of Acts. There are several prison scenes in the book of Acts. In fact, some of the greatest events in the book of Acts are a part of prison episodes, specifically the freedom from prison situations, rescue from prison situations, just to give you a reminder of what we've seen thus far in Acts chapter 5. Remember, the apostles were put into prison and the angel of the Lord rescued them in Acts chapter 12. Peter's in prison. Remember, the angel of the Lord, big bright light comes. He had to shake Peter up, wake him up, guides them out of the prison. Then in Acts chapter 16, Paul and Silas, they're in prison. Big earthquake happens. Remember that? And they don't do anything. They just stay there and chill out. Jailer wakes up ready to kill himself. Paul and Silas speak into his life. He comes to Jesus. Like big prison scenes. And I love that. Big rescues. Big rescues. Earthquakes and angels and light and conversions. I love all of that. I love the fact that God rescues in big ways. But can I suggest that most often God's rescue comes by way of nephews who happen to oversee or overhear a conversation, if you know what I mean. See, oftentimes God's rescue comes by way of that which is rather ordinary. No bright lights in this event. No shaking ground. No angel, at least an angel that we can see. Just some kid who does what he can, used by God to pave the way for a death-defying rescue. See, in our difficulties, so often we can make the mistake of demanding big and dramatic rescues, all the while missing possible relief that might be standing right next to us. Let's pick it up in verse 23, read through to verse 32. We're introduced to another rescuer, or at least what he does. We were introduced to him a little bit before, but now we get some insight to how he comes to Paul's aid. Then he called... Right, that's the tribune. Two of the centurions, those are individuals that oversee groups of 100 soldiers, and said, get ready, 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. It's nine in the evening. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. He's the governor of Judea. And he wrote a letter to this effect. All right. Obviously, Luke didn't have his own eyes on the letter, right? He's recording, so he records for us to this effect. This is what the letter said. Claudius Lysias, that's the tribune, to His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, speaking of Paul, and was about to be killed by them when I came up upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with them, just stop, or him, stop there. What do we get in this? Well, the furtherance of Paul's rescue, obviously we get in this, now coming with the support of the tribune of the cohort. We were introduced to him a couple of weeks ago when he rescued Paul from that riot scene back in Jerusalem. But now we get his name in verse 26, Claudius Lysias, as he writes a letter of commendation to the emperor, a man by the name of Felix. What's kind of amusing about his letter is his description of the events recorded in it, especially verse 27. Just look at verse 27 again. I love how he writes about what took place. He says, "This man was seized by the Jews, was about to be killed by them, when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen." That's not entirely true. Right? Remember, he was about to flog him. Right? He was about to get flogged. Then he found out he was a Roman citizen and said, oops, right? That. So he conveniently kind of changes things, because flogging a Roman citizen was a definite no-no, and that wouldn't have gone well with Felix. So he kind of changes things, but I think we can overlook that by just noting what he does for Paul. And note what he does. It's big time. I mean, he goes big with his support and rescue of Paul by providing 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen. Now, I don't know what that is. I assume it's a guy walking around with a spear. That's fantastic. Soldiers, horsemen, spearmen, and oh yeah, he gives Paul a horse to ride. 470 men in total. Almost 12 times the size of the 40 who plotted against Paul. History shows that the total Roman detachment that was housed in Jerusalem was 600. So what we have with Claudius Lysias is almost giving 80% of his troops to ensure Paul's journey to Caesarea was safe. You remember how daunting things looked for Paul back in verses 12 to 15? 40 men in bed with the religious leaders of the day. And now we get this provision and grace. You got 40, I got 470. I got 470. You got the council, I've got the governor. I've got the governor. And he gave me a horse. It's great, it's fantastic. I've got a horse. Spearman. Right? Spearman, it's great. Right? I mean, what's the point? You encountering any opposition in your life right now? You go, man, I got 40 people against me. I got 40. And they're in bed with these nut jobs. And they got a plan, or they're voted. And you're looking at it going, man, I know I've got promises of God and calls of God, but there's no, I can't. Look, that's way too daunting. Can you take some encouragement in this? I remember when we planted Westside. I mean, the opposition, the daunting aspect of it, right? We heard from people, mainly in the church, why are you doing that? I mean, it's way too expensive in Vancouver, and it is. It is way too expensive. People aren't interested in organized religion, to which I always say, we're very disorganized at Westside. Welcome here. Please come here. We're very, you'll love it. You'll love it here. Very But really, no, people don't move to Yale Town to go to church. Right? They just don't come to kids to go to church. So then it's not, you know, it's not, people aren't interested, right? People are actually anti-religion, anti-church. Nobody wants to know anything about the Bible. They're okay with Jesus. But if you talk about Jesus as the only way, holy moke, man, your inbox will be full. So it's that. And you know what? All of that's true. All of that's true. And there's some nights where you go, what have I done? What have we done? And God says, boy, you've got to see what I have for you here. I don't know what's going on in your life and what our enemy, the spiritual forces at hand, are causing you to step back, maybe shrink back. Can you take some encouragement in this? I think there's some truth in this. So what happens? Paul and his crew, they leave Jerusalem at 9 o'clock. The third hour is 9 o'clock at night. With all traveling 35 miles to a place called Antipatris, which was halfway to Caesarea. Difficult name, by the way, at least for me. where the threat would have been lessened. And therefore, the soldiers and the spearmen head back, but the 70 horsemen continue all the way to Caesarea with Paul. That takes us to verse 32. Let's read the last three verses. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. Here's my last point this morning, and it really just serves as a foundation to next week's message. But here it is. My last point this morning is that persecution and suffering is the means most often for gospel presentation. Remember, I talked about suffering and proclamation are the big, big items in what we've seen over the last number of chapters and we'll continue to see. So my point here again is persecution and sufferings is the means most often for gospel presentation. And I want to make sure you heard what I just said. I didn't say that persecution is the result of gospel proclamation. I said that persecution is most often the means of gospel proclamation. I'm going to begin just touching this week. I'll unpack it in greater detail next. But let me give you a taste of what I mean by having you read behind me on the screen from Colossians 1:24, where Paul, this same Paul, writes, "I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake," which is an amazing statement. "And in my flesh, I am filling up what is lacking in Christ's affliction. For the sake of his body, that is the church." Now, on a first read, this is a troubling verse. For what it looks like Paul is saying is that there was something lacking, not good enough in the work of Jesus on our behalf. Is that what Paul is saying? The answer to that is no. Paul isn't saying that Jesus' work was lacking in its effect or its accomplishment. His work on the cross, in our place, bearing the wrath of God for our sin, dying, defeating death, is altogether satisfying. Its effect is accomplished. It is finished. But it is lacking in its proclamation. Or to put it another way, people don't know about it in our world. And they need to know about it. Why do people need to know about the afflictions of Jesus? Why is that so important? Well, the reason is, because it's by and through the afflictions of Jesus that we are saved. If all you talk about is the niceties of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus, the example of Jesus, and you don't get to the afflictions of Jesus, and the cross of Jesus, and the payment of Jesus, you are presenting an incomplete gospel. It's by his stripes that we are healed. And how? We're going to unpack this more next week. But how is it most effective that the afflictions of Jesus are presented to the world? Well, as we're going to see more so next week, the best and most powerful way to present the afflictions of Jesus is through the afflictions of his people. And that's why Paul says, "I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake." One last verse to bring this home, which set things up for next Sunday. Paul writes this in Philippians 1. You can see it on the screen. "I want you to know, brethren," brothers, "that what has happened to me..." Okay, what's happened to you, Paul? He's in prison. He's writing this in prison. "That what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel." My imprisonment is serving to advance the gospel. Some of you have read the book of Romans and Romans chapter 8. There's that very well-known statement, "We are more than conquerors." How can you be more than a conqueror? How can you be more than a victor? What Paul is talking about, and we see it unpacked here, is that we do things more than just kind of surviving through them. So we do more than just survive prison. Prison serves the advance of the gospel. We do more than we just survive hard times, health reasons, those kinds of things, unemployment, hard relationships. We do more than just survive them. They serve to advance the gospel. That's why we're more than conquerors. So Paul says this. Boy, where'd it go? Please, can I have the Philippians passage back? La 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 la. Dun, 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 dun. I'll dance. Can we not go backwards? Pretty please? They're getting a call. Thank you. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is probably the most important three-letter word in the Bible. For Christ. You see what Paul's saying there? My imprisonment is not because of Christ. My imprisonment is not because I've been telling people about Jesus. Although that is true. But there's a bigger reason. My imprisonment is for Jesus. How is imprisonment for Jesus? It's advancing the gospel. And man, if I go to prison, right? Man, if I go to prison, where's my lawyer? Right? And put me in prison? I mean, what am I yelling? I mean, Paul's preaching. Where's my lawyer? Who are you? Get away from me. Right? Why is there no door on the John? I mean, come on. I mean, that the first thing you say when you watch someone on TV, there's no door on the John there. I don't look good in an orange onesie. Right? That kind of orange isn't my color. That's what I'm trying to tell you. That's me. What does Paul say? This imprisonment is going to serve to advance the gospel, and not simply because I have an audience that can't go anywhere, right? But because my joy is complete even while in prison. And in doing so, the afflictions of Jesus are further filled. And as we will see next week, Paul's imprisonment will lead to an audience with the governor, Governor Felix. And isn't that also true, that persecution oftentimes leads to audience that our normal day-to-day lives don't offer? As I close, I just have one question for us, Westside. What's your prison? How's your marriage? How's your health? How's your unemployment? How's your wayward child? How's that strife-filled relationship? All hard things. No doubt. No one here would say anything different. But is what is happening to you right now serving to advance the gospel, or is it being used by the enemy to bring defeat? Would you rise as we respond, please?